In the first lecture, I drew some blobs, right? I was saying, well, if I want to study the analog of a finite diagram in string theory, I need to do some calculations with the worksheet that looks like this, where some strings are coming from the past, doing something, and then going out in the future. And I was claiming that this sort of calculation can be written as an integral over complex structures. And then a path integral over the fields, and now we learned, some ghosts, maybe, with the action for the system, where all this path integral is done for these very simple free field theories. But I still have to do it on this blob. And, we're used to do calculations in things which are not blobs. Whether you study quantum field theory, usually you study it on a plane, right? Things are not as bad as they look, because, as I said, locally your metric can be chosen to be sort of flat by a Weyl transformation. So learning how to do these calculations is essentially on a blob like this is essentially the same as trying to learn how to make this blob as flat as possible. Still, when you look at this, this doesn't look like something globally flat. Doesn't look like a plane. But it secretly is. It's actually a plane without a collection of points. So in order to help understand this notion, it's useful to play with some Weyl transformations. Let me try to figure out how can I make the plane look like by doing weird Weyl transformations. So I have my plane with coordinates z and z bar. So and a flat plane has a metric which looks like this, dz dz bar. Good. Let me write some other metric which differs from this by Weyl transformation. First example, d squared equal to dz squared over z squared. This is a metric on the plane minus the origin, clearly, because it's divided by z squared. So on z minus the origin. How does this look like? Anybody can hazard a guess?
Like a very sharp cone, maybe.
Okay.
But actually should be something like, should be flat almost always, like large distances, but then close to the origin it should extend down.
Okay, let's try. I'm gonna use polar coordinates. So, the z squared is the same as the r squared plus r squared d theta squared, right? And I'm dividing by r squared. So that looks like the r squared over r squared plus d theta squared. So here I see a cylinder, I see a circle of constant size. And also I could use coordinates like r equal to e to the s, e to the tau, maybe. So this would become the tau squared. Tau is valued from minus infinity to plus infinity. So I have r times s1. This is a cylinder. So what happened is that I took my plane in polar coordinates. And I mapped it to an infinite cylinder, where the origin went to, say, the far past, and infinity went to the far future. OK, so this is one example. Now let's keep playing. Let me now try this metric. Ds squared equal dz squared over 1. Let me see, does this work? Yeah, 1 plus z squared. How does this look like? There are two regimes, you know, one where z is very small and one where z is very large. Can you merge them in your head?
Like a bowl?
Like
a bowl?
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes it's called a cigar for reasons that escape me. But that's right. So when z is very small, this is still flat. Kind of flat, at least close to flat. So there is still the origin there. But then as z grows, it becomes a cylinder. So a semi-infinite cylinder. Very good. So you could have seen this in two ways. Either you can think about that I took the plane and I made the infinity into a cylindrical region. Or you can think that I took the cylinder and I shrunk this past into a ball to get this. Because all these three are all related by phi transformations. So the flat plane minus the origin is the same as the cylinder. And the cylinder is also the same as the cigar minus the origin. So now, you can perhaps guess what I can do here. I can start doing wild transformations which cap off these semi-infinite directions. So, leaving with a little hole. So if I want to be democratic, I'll cut them all four off. Or I could just map this to the plane with 3 points missing, because I can open up any of these back into the plane. By the way, sorry, there was another thing I was supposed to, another space I was supposed to write here. Another metric, sorry. This is squared over 1 plus z squared squared. Can you guess how this met, what this is? Well, let me play with polar coordinates again. So this dr squared over 1 plus r squared squared plus r squared over 1 plus r squared squared d theta squared, something like that, right? I wonder if I got some signs wrong. So some numbers wrong, but I think this is correct. Suppose I want to say that this is some de alpha. Okay. That means that alpha, that R is tan alpha, I think. So R over 1 plus R squared is sine alpha, cosine alpha, I think, which is also sine of 1/2 sine of 2 alpha, or something like that. So the metric is starting to look like the alpha squared plus 1/4 sine square 4 alpha, the theta squared, 2 alpha, the theta squared. Let me put I should put a 4 in front of everything. I forgot, that's why I was having momentary troubles. Okay. That's your metric on a sphere. So what happened is now near the origin, I've done not much, but at infinity I shrunk things even more than here. I shrunk it back until it completely closed off. So this gives you this, a sphere. So if you relate the cylinder to a sphere minus 2 points, or the plane to a sphere minus 1 point. So it's called the conformal compactification of the plane. Now my origin is still there, and infinity became a point on the sphere. And so here what I did was essentially to map this more complicated blob back to a sphere.
Mm-hmm. When we did the mapping from the cigar to the sphere, we're missing a point on the sphere?
Yes.
Okay.
That's right. Okay. So I can reduce this calculation to this calculation, because it's a one-invariant theory, as long as I can sort of speak reasonably about what do I do at these points to mimic the effect of placing some states in these semi-infinite cylinders. So here I was supposed to pick some state for the string theory, which, as we learned last time, is a state inside the Hilbert space of this theory with special properties. And so I'm supposed to be able to sort of compute the path integral of this theory with specific states inserted in the semi-infinite cylinders. And I want to convert it to a path integral on a sphere or on a plane with something done at these points. Now, it turns out that the sphere is a very natural place to do calculation for a conformal field theory, for a two-dimensional conformal field theory. In many ways, it's even better than the plane, because I don't have to worry about boundary conditions anywhere. It's a nice compact space-time, Euclidean space-time. So a very natural thing to do when I study the sphere is to take an operator and place it at the origin, and another operator and place it at infinity. Now, when I say these words, you should already worry a bit. What do you mean, placing an operator on a sphere? How do I talk about local operators on a sphere? Do we need to worry? I mean, there is curvature here. Are operators in the presence of curvature defining the same ways in flat space, what are you talking about? These should be worries. These worries are not problematic on a wild invariant theory, because I can always do a wild transformation. Meaning, suppose I take a shapeless blob again, some weird space, and I want to talk about a local operator placed here. Well, suppose I pick some local coordinate in a patch, so that this point is z equal to 0. Then I can always do a wild transformation so that the local metric is just this is squared. So the local metric is flat. As the local metric is flat, I can use whatever definition of operator I like from flat space, because the definition is purely local. And then I can import it here. So given any operator, any abstract operator in flat space, and a choice of local coordinate, it makes sense to talk about O at zero. The choice of local coordinate matters. If I change my local coordinate, I have changed the metric. And so I had done a wild transformation locally. My operator might change. The simplest possibility is that, for example, I could take another coordinate z tilde, which is lambda z. Then, so let me just put a little z here to remember which coordinate I was using. Then the operator placed in coordinate z tilde at 0 might not be the same as the operator placed at z in 0. But if lambda is a constant, it's not too bad. I'm just doing a scale transformation or a rotation in this flat metric. And so we know how things are going to transform. If this operator has spin, I'm going to get a phase on the rotation. And this operator will have some scaling dimension, which tells me how it transforms under dilatation. So, and now I'll surely get the powers wrong. But I think I put lambda to the delta, lambda bar to the delta bar. Here. So there are these two numbers called the scaling dimensions, the holomorphic and anti-holomorphic scaling dimension. See, I could also write this as absolute value of lambda to the delta plus delta bar, and then argument of lambda. Something like that. So this is my rotation, and this is my scale transformation. So these two numbers are the property that the sum is the dimension, the scaling dimension, and the difference is the spin and should be quantized. So it should be an integer or a half integer if you have spinors.
Mm-hmm. What's the difference of the spin?
Sorry?
Why is the difference the spin of the operator?
Because it's what is the power that appears in this lambda or lambda bar. This is the angle of rotation of your coordinate system. This is the phase. I'm transforming z tilde by lambda z, which means the phase of z tilde differs from the phase of z by the phase of lambda.
Can I have operators under a fixed scaling dimension delta delta bar? But I can change the spins, right?
Well, the scaling dimension is delta plus delta bar. The spin is delta minus delta bar.
And so, one more question. Why does the scaling dimension split into delta delta bar?
It's just a convention. I'm not saying anything deep here. I'm just saying it's conventional to, instead of talking about scaling dimension and spin, to talk about this two number, delta and delta bar. I have two numbers, whose sum is something and whose difference is something. So I'm not losing any information or gaining information. So just a convention. These are called the holomorphic and anti-holomorphic scaling dimensions. They're just convenient because, you see, they control the behavior under sort of the holomorphic and anthropomorphic parts of the wild transformation. Later on, we'll discuss what happens when you do more general coordinate transformations. But for now, just let me leave it at that. So now I have a meaning of what it means to put an operator here at a point on the sphere. And so I can take this two-point function. And in Euclidean signature, unitary quantum field theory has a nice property called reflection positivity. If you draw a picture which has a reflection symmetry, the answer is positive. It's a positive real number. Concretely, that means that if I put, so let me call this the correlation functions of O prime infinity O of 0 on S2. Now, I'm doing it 0 and infinity. If it bothers you, I could have just picked any other two points that are sort of antipodal. I could have put 1 and minus 1, whatever. There is nothing specific about. No, the picture is rotational invariant. So I could have picked any antipodal points. But this has the property that if I take an operator in its complex conjugate, this is positive. So again, the sphere correlation functions give me a sesquilinear inner product on the space of local operators, positive definite inner product on the space of local operators. So the space of local operators is starting to look like a Hilbert space, which is not something which is true in a generic theory.
So this is only if you take the operators one at like one point and the other at like the antipodal point?
Yes. Now, you can do something more general. You could say, okay, I'll place them at points. When I use coordinates on the sphere, when I label points on the sphere, I only always mean the coordinate on the plane related to the sphere by the wild transformation we do up there. So that's why I call this infinity and this zero instead of north and south pole. So I could have put pole operators at any two points. And you can use global conformal transformations to relate any two points, actually any three points. On any triple of points on the sphere. So I could use a translation to put z2 at 0. Then I could use an inversion to send z2 at infinity. And then another translation to move this at the origin. So this has the same information as this. And you can use conformal symmetry to show that this is 0 if delta 1 is different from delta 2. On the other hand, if they are the same, it's some number, sort of over absolute value of z1 minus z2 to the z1 minus z2 to the delta 1, true delta 1, z1 bar minus z2 bar, the true delta 2. This is not a difficult calculation. You can recover this result by literally doing what I was saying, to do sort of translating and inverting. But you need to know how operators transform. And actually, under inversion, delta one bar, you're right. So this is an aside, I didn't want to get into this, but then these are the numbers that have the positive definite property. Anyway, let me ignore this for now. So there is another observation which is worth making, that is, if I now look at this cigar, I can do a calculation where I put my operator at the tip of the cigar, and I put a state here. So this gives me a pairing between operators and states. Or if you want, a map from operators to states. So you can take the state generated by this path integral, and I can call it O. And if you sort of, you can take the sphere and make it look like something like that. Something which is just two cigars glued together. And this shows you that this sort of pairing that I was discussing is just the pairing between the states associated to the operators. So we found a way to embed operators into the space of states. We found a positive definite in a product, which is just the product of the corresponding states. So I get a map from operators to states. Now, you could reasonably ask, is this map surjective? It's definitely injective, meaning if an operator maps to a state which is zero, I would contradict this statement, because this in a product will be also zero. It's supposed to be positive. So I'm definite, if I sort of represent an operator by its state, I'm not losing any information. What you can reasonably ask is this map surjective? Can I find for any state, can I find some linear combination of operators which will represent it? And the question is a bit more subtle. And when you start asking these questions, you should ask yourself questions like, what is an operator? Meaning, I'm asking, can I find an operator doing something? But in order to answer this question, I need to understand what are all the possible operators I can talk about. So if I asked you, what's an operator in a quantum field theory, like the free scalar? What would be your answer? Can you give me examples of operators in the theory of a free scalar?
Binomials in the field.
OK, that's right. So we had our x. We were taking derivatives of x2. We did something like the stress tensor, which was dx dlx. So I can definitely do polynomials in x and its derivatives. These are definitely operators.
Things that raise and lower the energy. Things that raise or lower some energy.
So let's be careful with the name here. It's a very unfortunate name. So operators are in local operators are called operators, but they're not the same as operators. So the notion of local operator transcend the notion of Hilbert space. Local operators are things that enter in correlation functions. Now, you can express correlation functions as inner products in some Hilbert space and think about operators as some, and so and try to embed operators inside the actual operators in the Hilbert space. But not, these are very special. You know, these are disturbances at one point. If you write a raising operator like an, an is not a local operator, right? We can write the definition of an, right? So we had that x del x was a sum of over n of an e to the n s, right? Something like that. We can invert this. You can say that an is the integral from 0 to 2 pi of del x of s sigma e to the n sigma, something like that. Call it an I. Well, let me just call this S. S was something like a, S was a function of sigma and tau. Anyway, so I've wrote A in terms of a local operator, but this local operator is mirrored over a whole circle. So I have my cylinder, I have my del x, which is a local operator. I multiply by something and integrate over a circle to get a raising operator. So raising operators are definitely made out of local operators, but it would be difficult to make to do something like place a raising operator at a point. That would not be a meaningful notion. I could definitely act on this state with the raising operator by inserting an extra puncture and integrating, and we'll do so momentarily. So you can definitely ask, you know, how do I represent the action of raising lowering operators on states in this language?
So are you saying that not everything that you can build out of local operators is necessarily a local operator?
That's right. So here, when I said the polynomial in the x's, they are all supposed to be evaluated at the same point. So a local operator is something that I can, that is, so it's a question I ask my quantum field theory at a point in space-time. And indeed, the space of local operators should be the space of all the questions I can ask quantum field theory at a point in space-time. These are definitely some of the questions I can ask. There might be other questions. And where you sort of identify two questions if they give always the same answer. So it turns out that in the theory of a scalar field, these operators are not enough to generate all the states. But that's OK, because they're also not enough to describe all the questions that we can ask. And a way to make things match is simply to ask questions which involve states. So let me do a final picture. So asking a question about to the quantum field theory at a point means essentially that I'm doing the usual path integral away from that point. But there I'm doing something more special, something different. The something different might be the insertion of some function of the fields, or maybe something else. Now, let me give an example of a so as long as I have a prescription, a rule on how to do a calculation, that will define an operator. So an operator is just a recipe. It's a recipe to do something which only affects the quantum field theory at a point and produces an answer which I can call a correlation function. So let me give a recipe to define an operator here. The recipe is the following. Do a wild transformation to explode the neighborhood of the point into a semi-infinite cylinder. And then place a state here. This defines the operator, defines the local operator labeled by a state. And then you can easily convince yourself that if I place this operator in a cylinder, in a cigar, which means I'm doing something like these, and placing my state I here, and try to read off which state I'm creating, well, this funny shape is the same as a cylinder in a wild invariant theory. So the state I'm creating is, by this operator, is the original state. So the correspondence between operators and states in a conformal field theory is actually one-to-one.
What kind of states can this build, cannot be built out of x delta x? Is there a
Yeah, now I'll give examples for the theory of free scalar, absolutely.
Ask a question.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
When you define the operators with that prescription.
Yes.
Exactly. How do we get the operator?
I just gave a recipe to do a calculation which only modifies the theory at one point and produces a number. So that defines an operator. This defines an operator. I'm trying to define operator OI. And the definition is I do a wild transformation and insert a state at the origin.
Really, we need a vacuum state to define the state.
You can totally ask which operator I'm getting if I place the vacuum here, the ground state here. So this is a local picture. I'm saying I'm trying to compute a correlation function on somewhere, and I want to place the special operator OI here. This is defined as doing the calculation on the same surface, but where I have taken this point and blew it out into enough cylinder, and then I'm placing the state I here. So I'm essentially pretty much trying to make sense of the picture up there. I'm saying I can definitely define some local operators such that that blob on the right is the same as that blob on the left. Now, the work will be to identify these local operators, give them a description I can use, an alternative description I can use in a simple calculation. But I'm trying to make the point that I can, at the very least, define abstractly some local operators which represent a half cylinder with a state. And that this definition will invert this map. So there was a map from operators to state, and I claim that there is also a map from states to operators, which inverts it.
Mm-hmm. Is the reason you're drawing the states as tubes because of some time evolution, or is there some?
A state, by definition, is something I can use to a path integral with which goes to the past.
So it's time evolution.
Yes, this is time evolution, that's right. But in Euclidean time, there is no difference between that time or that time. So what was your question?
Yes, I wanted to ask about how we build the state. Why do we know that all the states are well defined? Like when we do correlation functions in free theory, mm-hmm. we have divergences. Like, are mm-hmm. we building a states that have infinite norm?
The norm of the state is the sphere correlation function. They're perfectly good correlation functions. I mean, as long as the operators are well defined, correlation functions, local operators are finite as long as the operators are different points. So an operator is a recipe to get a finite correlation function. All the singularities you're talking about are aspects of the recipe, not aspects of local operators. So when I describe my theory as a free theory, and I try to describe local operators as polynomials in the fields, I need to be careful because this expression makes no sense. And instead, I can define it by, say, point splitting. That's a recipe to define a local operator. But the local operator itself is finite and nice. It's the recipe that has to go through some subtleties, renormalizations, or whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
So,
D
this example, like we only have free scalar field, all the things that you are saying about definition of operators.
It's all universal.
For any
theory which has finite correlation functions.
Is it somehow related to GLS construction?
To what?
GLS
construction. Kind of. I don't think they're used exactly the same way. So GNS has to do with observables, which are sort of things attached to whole regions. Local operators are an abstraction where you sort of imagine observables. We take the regions to be smaller and smaller and smaller until you get points. You can totally ask, why should I be able to do that? The question of understanding and defining local operators and what local means in a general quantum field theory is subtle, to me too. But conformal field theories are nice because they're scale transformations. So they give a canonical way to identify observables in regions of different size. And so taking a limit to size of to infinite to zero size is actually less stressful. Yes.
Clarify some. So the first statement we make is we have these set of shapes that are related through Weyl transformations.
Yes.
Okay. Well, one thing, is it Weyl transformations that matter or conformal transformations that matter, or is not a meaningful distinction?
It's not a meaningful distinction.
Sorry.
What I mean is
right?
The only notion is Weyl transformations. I'm using Weyl transformations. Conformal transformation.
Look like.
If it's a global conformal transformation, it's a symmetry. But it's smaller than Weyl symmetry, and it only applies to flat space or things with a conformal Killing vector. Local conformal transformations are coordinate transformations that are only defined locally, but they're not a symmetry then, they're just... So Weyl transformations are the correct language.
Okay.
Once you go to locally flat metric, you can express most of the information about Weyl transformations by how the patches are glued and things like that. And you get the word conformal.
Okay. Well, I have a theory that has conformal symmetry. Like,
but what we call conformal field theories are theories with Weyl symmetry.
What I call conformal theories are, they have Weyl symmetry.
Yes, that's what conformal field theory means. It's a theory with Weyl symmetry. Unfortunately, is one of the many examples where names in quantum field theory are poorly chosen because people understanding evolve really, really, really slowly. And textbooks are written historically. So both names and textbooks tend to be terrible at describing things in quantum field theory. Yes.
Okay, so now once we have this Weyl symmetry, we can leverage it to deform these surfaces into one another. And for some reason, ones which have go to infinity are associated to states with some sort of we're leveraging the fact that we can turn these circles at infinity into points to try to begin to map operators into states. That's somewhat of how I understood it.
So, a state is a notion that makes sense when you have a manifold which has a cylindrical end, and it's a recipe to produce a correlation function on this manifold.
So a state.
And there is sort of a linear space of states, and they have the properties that you can glue things. So states emerge when you think about cutting manifolds. So if I have a blob with a cylindrical end, another blob with a cylindrical end, and a nice flat metric on this cylinder, then I can sort of cut it and insert a complete set of states and write this as sort of a sum over the states of the blob, or an integral, depending on what basis I'm using, of the blob with one state inserted here and the other blob with the other state inserted here, with the dual state inserted there.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. So we can associate states to these cylindrical shapes, interestingly enough. It's about the...
Yes, so states are associated to cylindrical regions in space-time, where there is a notion of time.
Okay. Does it have to be also non-complex in a way to take, like, infinite time such that, I don't know, when I've seen these path integrals, there's an infinite decay?
It does not matter. So once you have these ends, you place your state, and it represents, I mean, if you insert it at different location, this differs by time translation, which is just an action of the Hamiltonian your state.
Okay.
So when you say insert a state in a cylinder, it means I cut the cylinder at some point, and I put a state there. And if I cut it another point, I need to update Hamiltonian evolution on that. So you're right that there is sort of a choice to make. But this formula holds as long as I'm cutting at this same place.
Okay. And just last question. To complete, so the argument here was to prove surjectivity in a way. We were asking, for every state, can we find an operator such that we can map that operator into that state to prove surjectivity?
Yes.
And then we said, well, we're going to build it. We're going to build the operator out of another state and then prove that with this operator you will get
the same state.
You get the identity.
Yes.
Why does the cylinder represent the identity map?
Because its volume is while equivalent to just this, which is a time evolution.
Is an identity map like
a
cantor?
Well, as I said, in the state operator map, there is always a. Depending on where you inserted the state, the operator that you get will get rescaled by an amount controlled by the scaling dimension.
Okay.
Right. When you insert it, you need to decide at which time you insert it, and always how much do you rotate it before you insert it. The choices will give you the same, changing your choice will give you the same operator up to this. Scale transformations.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Something I don't quite understand is like, are these kind of embedded in a higher dimensional space?
No.
So this is all there is?
Yes.
Okay, so it's not like we can think of like when we cut the tube, you know, you've got this little circle that's like a little like loop string, because that's all there is. It's a state. It's not embedded in that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, these are. Today is all about two-dimensional conformal field theory, mm-hmm. Unitary two-dimensional conformal field theories, mm-hmm. And that's the context. Mm-hmm.
I had a question just to clarify. The recipe is that we say if we have a state, and we want to compute the expectation value of some operators
mm-hmm.
with that state. Then the way you do that is by inserting this operator in the path integral.
Yes.
And then in what sense does the state live at, like, the bottom of the cylinder? Because, like, I would imagine that if you're computing the expectation values, you might take O1
mm-hmm.
and then some other operator at some other location.
Mm-hmm.
And you would compute, like, I guess you would insert both of those into the path integral.
Right, so I want to do this correlation function.
Yeah.
Now, it might be that this is the only operator I defined with this recipe, and the others are defined by other recipes. In which case, I'll do this calculation.
Oh, okay.
If they were all defined by this semi-infinite tube recipe, well, I could put three semi-infinite tubes.
I see. So it doesn't really make sense to talk about mixed, like having operators mixed with the state.
You can. Here it is. This is the defined inner product between states and operators, mm-hmm. or a map from operators to states.
Thank you.
Yes, go ahead.
You said something about the scale invariance of these operators?
Yes, or covariance, I should say. Yes.
But the first examples you gave were like x and del x. So I'm just struggling to understand how they can.
Yeah, good questions. That's right. So x has dimensions 0. So when I place x, I don't really need to worry much about the local scale. Del x, well, taking the holomorphic derivative changes the dimension, one of the dimension by one. Del square x, there's del x, which is a stress tensor, right? Has delta equal to 2, delta bar equal to 0. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Are the x's well-defined operators? Because I thought the only...
They're local operators. They're not primaries, but I've not said the word primary yet, so I'm allowed to write them.
Because I remember like reading that the only primary... Oh, they're not primary. Never mind.
Yes. Here I'm just talking about local operators. Depending on how much time I have, either today or next time, I can talk about primary local operators. Or I might have to refer to the note. I wanted to answer that question of what happens if I put zero, if I put the ground state here. Okay. So let's do this calculation here, but only, but pick one of the operators being the identity. So let me look at a correlation where I just put one here. So this will produce a state. And I would like to understand what are the properties of this state. So in order to do so, let me just specialize to the scalar field theory for just for instructional purposes. Let's ask how the modes of x act on 1. So I need to take the integral of del x times e to the, times some function of, what was e to the ns. Now, when I have this sort of state operator map, the e to the s coordinate along the cylinder, the s coordinate along the cylinder is related to the z coordinate near the origin as following e to the s. But anyway, even forget about this, what I'm gonna say, it's doesn't really need that much. So all I'm trying to say is that this is a contour integral of this conserved current. And here I'm not putting any operator because I'm putting the identity, which is like putting nothing. So I can try to sort of pull this contour, shrink this contour to zero and get zero. This will fail. This will only be possible if this function is, you know, extends continuously to the origin, which in terms of the cylinder, it means that the function is sort of decaying at infinity. So I'm going a bit fast because time is really limited, but so this is supposed to give you a n of 1. And with this argument, you can show that this equals to 0 if n is greater or equal to 0. So this state is annihilated by all of the create destruction operators. And it has p equal to 0 because a0 was p. So I can identify this with just the, sorry, I can identify 1 with the vacuum in the Hilbert space. On the other hand, if I want to obtain other states like a 1, a minus 1 on 1, well, I can do this I can still do this operation. Or if you want, I can take the cylinder and insert just del x. Del x, if you remember, is something like sum of a n e to the minus n s, or something like that. So if I want to get a 1 acting on my state, I can just sort of do some, I can do something which takes this coefficient. Or I can just actually bring this to the tip of the cigar and mind my normalization properly. Again, it's in the note. But you can argue that this is, which is the same as a minus 1 on the vacuum, is also the same as del x, the state created by del x. And in general, if you look at a state created by some polynomial in x, del bar x, and so on and so forth, this is the same as let me just take the del x's. As a one, as the same polynomial of a 1, a bar 1, etc., acting on the vacuum. So this answers the question, what states can I create with this? I can create the whole Fock space sitting on top of the vacuum. This leaves me with a problem. How do I describe this? You know, what's the operator which creates a momentum state? Okay. So if I was looking at a particle, quantum mechanics instead of quantum field theory, a state with momentum would just be written as e to the I px, right? Now, x is the zero mode of the field x. So you can try to argue that way, that op should be just e to the I px. Of course, this is even worse than a polynomial. It's a non-polynomial expression in the field. Regularizing this will require work. So I can put inverted commas there. For polynomials, we used point splitting regularization. For this, we had to work harder. You can do this in a variety of ways. But one very simple and intuitive way is to observe that when I do this path integral with an insertion of an exponential, well, why don't I just add this to the action? And this definition is pretty good. It's a recipe. And can help. And if I have multiple of these, you can just add them to the action. Or you can use other methods. You could say, OK, I will try to define first something like this. Maybe I take a little bump function, something that something centered around the origin, but a bit smooth. And then try to take a limit as the bump goes to a delta function. Now, if I just do this, I get infinity. but it turns out that you can sort of regularize it in a way that makes sense. So sort of subtract off the result of the weak contraction, sort of. Something like that gives you a valid definition, for example. That's a bit like what we did for the stress tensor, except that we need to do sort of smeared point splitting, version point splitting. So again, it's just a matter of recipes. You can produce a recipe, he can produce a recipe, everybody can give their own recipe for an operator, it's fine, as long as they give the same answers in correlation functions. They're all equally valid. So these are the missing ingredients that ultimately allow to do calculations like that. So here I need to insert states which has some momentum and some oscillators in front. And I can represent them in here by some polynomials on the derivatives times e to the ipx. And then you can give a prescription on how to do this calculation. And so you end up with what's essentially a correlation function on a sphere, or even a plane, or some fancy operators. But this correlation function can be just done by weak contractions. So it's nothing difficult.
Mm-hmm. For all the construction, we have used the states that we studied for the before.
Yes.
Everything is like very dependent in having the free theory and being able to construct the Hilbert space for the free theory.
Yes.
How do we do it if we don't have that?
Well, so essentially you could say that our ability to define to compute calculations in string perturbation theory is directly controlled by our ability to do calculations in two-dimensional quantum field theory. So every advance in doing calculations in two-dimensional quantum field theory produces for you new computational tools in string theory, in perturbative string theory. But in general, it's hard. We have very few ways to do calculations in two-dimensional quantum conformal field theory. But there are situations where you can, so there are two sorts of situations you can work with. One possibility is that for some reason you can still exactly solve your two-dimensional conformal field theory. Some miracle happens that allows you this exact solution. This could be, for example, integrability, or something like that. The other possibility is that maybe you cannot do all calculations, but there are some calculations you can do. So when you have supersymmetry, some calculations can be done.
I think that my question is, when you say some calculation, like some calculations means in the Hilbert space, or you can do this with...
No, it typically means some part of the Hilbert space you have more control on, which means that some of the scattering amplitudes in string theory or some of the processes in string theory you have more control on.
When I'm trying to compute correlation functions of the exponential operator,
yes.
One thing you said is to add it to the action.
Mm-hmm.
When we do it, we still have to do this bump function regularization?
Not necessarily. I mean, of course, you still need to tell me how to do calculations in action like this. So I just moved the...
In what sense can that be viewed as a Gaussian integral?
Yeah, exactly. No, this is a Gaussian integral. Because X, so S was quadratic, S is interlinearly, So that definitely facilitates calculations. But you're right, in practice, you might have to still bump it and things like that. So put an F here and then subtract this constant. Yes.
Mm-hmm. There we have like A1 and A bar, negative one, A bar negative one. But what?
Minus one, yes, you're perfectly right. I don't know why I put ones. Yes, it was supposed to be minus ones.
What about the other A negative ends?
Second derivative, third derivative, fourth derivative. So, d to the nx goes to a minus n, zero. Yes. And, yes, something I want to say, yes. So, our inability to solve two-dimensional quantum field theory is really the biggest limitation in pushing holography beyond and things like that, beyond what we can do now. For example, it's a fact that Young-Mills at large n is a string theory, by definition, pretty much. But we don't know how to write down a worksheet theory for that string theory that would make this statement useful. People definitely try to study this question. But and I could imagine one day being able to sort of very carefully characterize which properties this two-dimensional quantum field theory should have, and then bootstrap it. So I've hopes at some point the conformal bootstrap apply, or the bootstrap in general apply to two-dimensional quantum field theories, might push further our ability to do string theory calculations. Perturbative string theory calculations.
Mm-hmm. One quick question about this operator. What is like what is the scaling dimension and the speed?
Yes. Delta P is P squared over 2. And the reason it comes about is manifest. If I change my definition of the local coordinate z, the log shifts by log lambda. And so I end up with getting lambda to the p squared. So that's the very reason in the note I introduced this bump regularization, is to show this fact. And if you know what primary means, these are actually primary operators, meaning that the transformation standard, general coordinate transformations, is nice.